I'm professional investigator Justin Yentis. Here, we cut through the noise, dig deep, and uncover what others overlook. If you're ready to roll up your sleeves and get to the bottom of the story, you've come to the right place. Welcome to Truth Be Found. Let's get to work.
Before we debate a video clip, before we argue headlines, before we choose a side, we have to ask one question. What does the law really say? If you care about civil rights, about police accountability, use of force, or due process, what we discuss today will provide a foundation for that. Make sure you subscribe, turn on the notifications, and leave a comment with your questions. This series is built on facts, law, and real dialogue, and not just hot takes. So this episode lays the legal groundwork for our series. We break down two controlling Supreme Court precedents, Graham versus Connor and Tennessee versus Garner, that govern the use of force analysis in the United States. We walk through what objective reasonableness really means, what deadly force limits are, and how civil remedies like 42 U.S.C. 1983 operate when constitutional rights are violated. So today I'm joined by Joey Hamby, a self-defense expert with the Attorneys for Freedom, and Matt Browning, who's been on before, who is a former police officer and who spent years undercover with white supremacist groups. And I want to thank you both for being here.
Glad to be here.
Great to be here, Justin.
Joey, could you tell us briefly about your work with Attorneys for Freedom and what draws you to self-defense law specifically?
Sure. So we've got a number of factors. So Attorneys for Freedom is a law firm based here in Chandler, Arizona. However, though we're based in Chandler, we represent clients in 50 states. Mm-hmm. So we represent people all across the nation, but exclusively in self-defense cases. And we are the law firm that backs the Attorneys on Retainer program. Okay. Attorneys on Retainer provides legal defense for individuals who are involved in self-defense events around the nation. And Attorneys for Freedom, we're the only law firm in the nation that is dedicated exclusively to self-defense. I have been a practicing attorney since 1994. Mm-hmm. I only practice in criminal defense. I'm a certified specialist with the State Bar of Arizona. There's tens of thousands of attorneys in the state of Arizona. There's, I think, around 54, 55 of us that are certified specialists in criminal defense. I'm a native of Arizona, and I have always believed just fundamentally in our freedoms that are espoused in the Bill of Rights. That is one of the things that has made such a perfect fit with me and all of the attorneys at Attorneys for Freedom. Attorneys for Freedom isn't about getting you out of jail. Attorneys for Freedom is about protecting your liberties, your freedoms, your rights. Not just the First Amendment, not just the Second Amendment, but all of them, all of the rights that we have. And so we're very, very focused on that. We understand that people are humans, that they make mistakes. That doesn't matter to us at Attorneys for Freedom. We're going to represent our clients. We're going to do it to the best of our ability. We're going to make sure that the constitutional protections are there for them.
Excellent. Excellent. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the perspective that you're bringing to the table on the self-defense law and all the experience that you've got to bring to this conversation today. Matt, if you could give us a quick sense of your law enforcement background and what perspective you'd like to bring today.
Sure. First of all, I was with the Mesa Police Department for 20 years. During that time, I spent 13 plus years undercover with white supremacist groups, not just here in Arizona, but throughout the nation and world. Hate travels, and so I kind of traveled with it. Mm-hmm. I was on two FBI task forces. I was on the Fugitive Task Force and the Joint Terrorist Task Force. And during that time, I, again, did all the white power, all the supremacy that was going on. My take on what I bring is an experience. I hate to say this phrase, but I've been there, done that.
Right.
You know, I've been involved in shootings. I've had people pull guns on me. I've had all these crazy things happen. And there's sometimes that as a police officer, I know what the rules are, what the laws are. But there's always the times that you do it or don't you do it? Split second. And in that split second, people's lives change. And like you were saying, that's why we have attorneys that help protect our liberties and our freedoms. Mm-hmm. And I just bring that perspective of really the stress that comes from being involved in shootings, the stress that comes from having people pull guns on you. You know, a lot of what I've done is my wife, Tawny, and I wrote a book, The Hate Next Door. And And we write about these experiences. And hopefully what we can talk about on this show now is just how we can understand each other and how we can protect each other and how, you know, maybe it's not what you see on TV is really what happened. You know, because it's the perspective of the person. It's me as a police officer and what I've been trained to do, fighting what I morally should do or fighting what I should legally do.
Right.
And so, yeah, I'm looking for a good conversation.
Excellent. And you and I met on an Aryan Brotherhood case. I think it was about, five or eight years ago. And I don't know how long it's been at this point. And I thoroughly enjoyed getting to know you and reading your book. I will put the link in the show notes, I think, as we have before. It's a fantastic book. Gave me a lot of perspective on the people that I'd been working with on the defense side for the last couple of decades, and saw how they interacted and
well,
treated you kind of poorly.
But I tell you what, it's taken me this long to say that I've actually worked with the defense now, and I actually have working relationships with defense attorneys because, I mean, as a police officer, no, prosecution. But that's not, there's two sides of every story, two sides of justice. And we just need to make sure we get to the right side of the justice for each individual case.
In fact, Joey and I think met on, at least it was my first capital case, on a case that you might have some insight on. We'll have to talk about after. So if we don't start with the law, we end up arguing emotions. So let's start where the court starts. And I'm going to give a brief overview of the Supreme Court case, Graham versus Connor.
Can I interrupt just for a second? Because I wanted to follow up on something Matt said that I think was really important in what you're alluding to, which is in today's world, we almost have two completely separate areas. We've got a narrative and we've got the facts. And it feels like today nobody cares about the facts. It's just the narrative. You know, all I want to know is what are your politics? What's your view on this issue or that issue? Yeah, we really need to focus on what the facts are when we're working on these cases and see the whole picture, not just what somebody's political ideology is.
Exactly.
It's so true. It's so true. And, you know, it's whenever we have these issues that erupt on social media or in the news, you know, folks are very quick to take sides based on, you know, a snippet from a video camera.
Yeah.
And and as we all know, getting into a case, there's hundreds, if not more, options to of, you know, perspective to bring to the table before you make that decision. So let's go back to 1984. A guy named Graham is having a diabetic insulin reaction. His blood sugar's crashing and he needs orange juice fast. So he runs into a convenience store, sees the line is too long, and rushes back out to the car. So now put yourself in the shoes of Officer Connor. Well, Matt, you can probably give some perspective on this, who's sitting in his patrol car. He just watched the man sprint into the store and sprint right back out. Now, what does that look like? Connor pulls him over. Graham tries to explain that he's diabetic. That doesn't matter. He gets handcuffed, thrown into the squad car, slammed into the hood, ends up with a broken foot and some other injuries. Now, at this point, he hadn't done anything wrong. He was just going in trying to buy some orange juice for his insulin. Now, his lawsuit made it to the Supreme Court, and the question became, how do we judge whether police force is constitutional? And the court said that used the Fourth Amendment's objective reasonableness standard, judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene and not in hindsight. So let's dig into this, Joey. The court laid out three factors: the severity of the crime, the immediate threat, and whether the person is resisting or fleeing. Now, in your experience with self-defense cases, are courts weighing all of these equally, or does one tend to carry more weight?
So, interesting question, but I'm going to tell you in certain ways it's actually a little bit different than that. And the reason for that is Graham is actually a 1983 action. So it is a lawsuit for civil rights violations. Now, there is a lot of overlap between criminal cases and civil rights cases, but it's not complete. It's not total. And in fact, when it comes to areas like this where somebody is looking to be able to sue an officer and get past what we call qualified immunity, that's where the court is making this type of standard. When we're on the ground, like you were for a couple of decades, Matt, we know what courts are looking at there when they look at your work over your shoulder, right? Mm-hmm. Sitting in a nice bright courtroom with no danger going on, nobody screaming at you, you know, nobody firing guns at you or anything. And what they want to do is they want to say, well, let's look at it with the totality of the circumstances and take all of these things into account. And yes, these are some of the factors that come into account here. So what the person is doing, you know, are they fleeing? Are they a threat to others? Also, what's some of your knowledge about this person? Mm-hmm. If the knowledge I have about this person is, well, I just pulled him over and, you know, now he says he's having, you know, diabetes issues and he's having insulin shock or whatever the case may be. I don't know. Do people ever lie to you, Matt?
A few times.
People tell you things sometimes as a police officer that aren't true.
Sure.
As a defense attorney, as an investigator,
oh, yeah.
Our own clients will tell us things that aren't true. So that part doesn't shock me. But if you know certain things, you know, oh, wow, I've dealt with this person before. He's got a history of violence or schizophrenia or autism, or he matches the description of somebody that just robbed a bank. That all goes into the mix of what the officer thought at the time. And that's what Graham really stands for, in my opinion, is not the situation where you can just simply look at it now and you make up your own decision. You make up your own mind as a judge sitting in a nice, safe courtroom. Put yourself on the street. Think of all those things coming at you in real time and then decide what would an objective and reasonable officer do in those circumstances. So the court's really trying to give us some guidance here on all of those different factors that they're looking at. So I know that's kind of a long-winded answer. I hope it answered it a little bit,
though. Oh, it does. It does. And I think that's what this case, at least to me, has always put at the forefront of my mind, is to put myself back in the situation on the street, not sitting in my office, you know, with a soda on my desk in my nice chair. So Matt, let's talk about that in real life.
Mm-hmm.
From an officer's perspective on the street, I know you told a story once about an interaction that you had with a guy on the freeway,
right,
that put a gun to your chest. So I'm imagining at that point you weren't running through a legal checklist of, is this reasonable? What do I know about this guy? What do those factors mean in the heat of the moment?
Absolutely nothing. They mean nothing to me in that moment, because the problem is that we'll start with the orange juice. Any reasonable officer would believe, or any reasonable person would believe, that crime is afoot. So mm-hmm. you look out, you see, yeah, there's a crime. He ran out. It's a misdemeanor shoplifting. Or is it a robbery? Robbery's a felony. So as a police officer, when you're looking, you don't know until you detain that person, and then you can find out what's going on from there. And so that whole detention process is, I believe, where it gets sticky, and we have to investigate what's going on. And then once you investigate, that's when you pull in the background. That's when you pull in he's diabetic. That's when he needs insulin. That's when you pull in all these other things. Now, when somebody sticks a gun in your chest, mm-hmm. there's no time to...
All that goes out the window.
That goes out the window. Now, in a split second, I have to think, am I going to shoot this guy or fight this guy?
Yep.
And as a reasonable officer, or reasonable person, forget the police officer portion of it. I'm just a person who has a gun stuck in my chest. How would a reasonable person react to that situation?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we could probably sit here and list all kinds of different reactions that different people are going to have. And so for me, I don't desire, want to, need to shoot anybody. Been there, done that. I don't need to do it again. And so that in that situation, he didn't get shot. But he did go to jail for what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's different things as a police officer that we have to do all in the split second amount of time that is going to either put the suspect in jail, put me in jail, sue me later on in a civil lawsuit, and I lose my house, my job, everything I have because of that split second decision I make. And then back to the court part, if a police officer is sitting on the stand and he is being, are they juries of his peers? Because you give me 12 cops, they'll side with me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But if you give me 12 just citizens from the valley here, they're not going to understand what goes on in a police officer's mind and what goes on in a police officer's life that causes the training or the stresses and training that we go through they just don't get it and don't understand it.
Well, I think that that would be, that puts a big amount of responsibility on Joey and your colleagues and yep. you know, all of us that work in criminal defense to try and bring the crime to the jury mm-hmm. and try and have them see this without the benefit of hindsight. And Joey, can you talk to that?
Yeah.
Why is it that the courts don't allow a perfect hindsight, and what are the struggles of bringing that to a jury's perspective?
And that is a huge problem mm-hmm. because it is impossible to put somebody in that setting and you know, really do it justice. We do the best that we can on all sides, but we understand that a court system is not a reenactment, it's not a recreation of all of the events and putting those people back in the same place. But what we are trying to do, and what the court is trying to do here with this three-factor test, is in the time that it takes to say the three factors, the events already happened, mm-hmm. right?
Correct.
So what it's really trying to do is say, this is what reasonable people do under these circumstances. So if you just look them and you break them down, the first one is the severity of the crime.
Right.
Well, as an officer, if you've got a 12-year-old who just shoplifted some bubble gum, mm-hmm. is that going to get the same treatment as the bank robber that shot and killed somebody and they're fleeing and you're chasing them? Of course not. Right. Everybody understands that. And that's a type of proportionality. That's the same type of proportionality analysis that we want to do in a self-defense shooting, right? If somebody is coming at me screaming, as a civilian, coming at me screaming, I'm going to kill you, and they're coming at me, do I have the right to shoot and kill them? Maybe I do, maybe I don't. Under one circumstance, it's a 6'2", 240 MMA fighter that just got out of prison and he's got a shiv. Mm-hmm. Right? The other one, it's an 85-year-old lady on a walker, right? So it's proportionality.
Right.
It's the severity of the event. That's something that as officers, you make that judgment like that, okay? And then we go with the facts that you knew, not the facts that we know later on, because we're going to get all sorts of facts later on about what happened and who this person was and what they were doing. Was it Jeffrey Dahmer or was it Mother Teresa? Mm-hmm. Well, when you're the officer on the street, you don't know that. So all you know, you're dealing with the severity of the facts that you have, and that's how the court is saying we're going to look at it. We're not going to Monday morning quarterback this sucker. We're going to put ourselves right in the heat of the moment the best we can. The next component of this, and I don't know if I could put more or less importance on this, but this is a pretty important component, which is, what's the threat? Was there an immediate threat? Well, in this case where a guy's pointing a gun at you, I don't care if he shoplifted bubblegum or if he murdered five people, it's an immediate threat right now. And not just if he's pointing at me, pointing it at somebody in my family or a third party or something like that. So it's that immediacy of that threat and the severity of it that really overrides some of that previous information that you know. And then the last thing is whether they're actively resisting or attempting to flee. I don't want to get, you know, people all stirred up and talk about political stuff, but the first thing that comes to my mind under circumstances like this are some of the really bad cases that we've seen nationally. Mm-hmm. I remember so well watching the videos from, you know, unfortunately, the case up in Milwaukee, the George Floyd case. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, and I've talked to many officers. I'm good friends with a lot of officers and detectives. I have no idea what was going on in that officer's mind at that moment in time. But unfortunately, it made for some, you know, really bad facts. As a defense attorney, I was looking at that like, I don't know how I defend that at that point.
Right.
I just don't know how. Because at that moment, whatever the severity of the crime was, at this point, there's no immediate threat. Right? And so how I address that situation has got to change if there's no immediate threat. And again, I'm not saying there's not a background and a history, because there was, but there was no immediate threat at that moment. Now, I understand we could say somebody's actively resisting or attempting to flee, but all of that, again, is on a sliding scale. You got somebody handcuffed, face down on the ground.
You have none of
what
the above.
What can they really do?
You have no attempting to flee. You have no active aggression.
Yeah. So those are the types of situations that we're looking at. Now, do you try to put yourself back in that officer's headspace? You do the best that you can. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we just can't. And to this day, I haven't actually heard an explanation for what was going on in his headspace at that point in time. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't something that met any of these criteria, unfortunately.
Well, I think that's too, in Arizona, we have the fleeing felon rule. law. I mean, if a felon's running, you can shoot him. And are you going to shoot him? Because now you have the contradiction of, okay, he's a felon, he's running. Okay, I'm going to shoot. Or he's a felon and he's running. The threat is no longer here and it's leaving. So now you're violating, you know, is a threat still present? Is there is still imminent threat? Yeah. And that would be a no. So, you know, sometimes law contradicts reality or reality contradicts everything. And so in a police officer's mind, you know, there's good cops, there's bad cops. We all know that. There's good attorneys, bad attorneys. There's horrible podcasts and great podcasts. That's just how it is in life. And when you have some police officers that have even all the training that you can possibly do to a person or give to a person is just not enough.
Yeah.
And what happened with George Floyd, I, like you, no idea what was going on in his head, but as soon as those cuffs are on, I'm off.
Yeah.
It's gone. I'm putting him in the back of a car. Threat's gone.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Let's get on with life.
Yep. I certainly want to address what you said about the fleeing felon when we get to Garner. I definitely want to talk about that because I wish things in life were so cut and dried.
Yeah,
exactly.
So,
well, and that brings us to our next topic about, you know, Matt, you mentioned how things change in the moment. We always hear about these rapidly evolving situations, right? So can you walk us through what it actually feels like? I know, you know, from my own work, when we're tracking someone down or we're in a bad neighborhood, we're in, you know, El Salvador, I'll end up in the, you know, the wrong neighborhood, the wrong place in Mexico. And the situation can turn sideways, sometimes almost on a dime. And I know you've got some pretty good, solid examples from the streets of how fast decisions are made when you're put into those situations.
Luckily, as a patrol officer in your car, you get dispatched to the call. And so as you're going to the call, dispatch is getting information from the person who's there telling you what's going on. And so you kind of prepare yourself as you're going. But as soon as you get to a call, well, say like a domestic violence call, you know, the husband's beating up the wife, and you get there and you go to arrest the husband, then all of a sudden the wife jumps on your back, the 14-year-old son comes and starts kicking and punching you.
Mm-hmm.
You had no idea this was going to happen. So now not only are you fighting the husband, now you have two other people that you're fighting. I had the experience where I was on a traffic accident and I'm trying to provide life-saving tactics, techniques to the passenger of a car. I didn't know that somebody passing by knew who the passenger was, called their parents. And now I'm fighting mom and dad who showed up to get their daughter out of their car who had just died in this car accident.
Oh boy.
So now I'm trying to keep them away from seeing their daughter in the situation. They don't know that. So I'm fighting against them. In police work, it is a hot and cold thing. It is super cold, then all of a sudden in a drop of a hat is hot. And that's just the way it goes. And you have to be able to see and sense that these things are going on. When we go into a bad neighborhood, you know, the hair on the back of your head starts going up. But cops live life with the hair on the back of their head going up.
Mm-hmm.
And we just have to, in one of my shootings, it was like, holy cow, that was quick.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're going to go take this guy off. He shot at Phoenix PD. He's running. We found him, and we're just going to go box him in and take him off. And next thing you know, he's shooting at us, and we're shooting at him. And it's all in split seconds.
Right.
But you have to be able to, I think we prepare ourselves for that. And training is kind of, at times, out the door. Because we have to mentally prepare ourselves every day when we go to work. And we expect that it's going to happen. And maybe that's why we have these situations of police brutality or bad things happening, because we're already preparing ourselves as we're driving to get our patrol car, or I'm driving from my home to a surveillance, or I'm going to an undercover gig or whatever it might be. We are already mentally preparing ourselves for the worst possible event.
And that brings us to an important aspect. You know, I know in every shooting case that I've had, we've always gone after training information for the officers. If you've got a civilian that ends up taking someone's life in a self-defense situation, maybe they've got a CCW, maybe they have some NRA training or some firearms handling training. You know, we're looking at these police shootings through the standard of, you know, a reasonable officer on the scene, but, you know, reasonable can mean a lot of different things. Joey, how do you feel that the training factors into that reasonableness factor? If an officer is poorly trained, does that change what is considered reasonable?
So, yes and no.
Mm-hmm. Classic
so,
answer.
Yeah, exactly. Classic answer. So, I think that can matter a lot, particularly on the civil side of cases, mm-hmm. which again, I stay out of those. But officer training, an agency's training program, all those sorts of things can really matter. In other words, if you're standing up an agency and you're giving people guns and badges and saying, go out and do good, and you do a really bad job at it, you probably should get smacked across the nose.
Right.
Right. And it's hard to put an agency in prison. Mm-hmm. And that's not what civil rights cases are about, but they do bring financial pain. And so I think that does matter in terms of the training. I will tell you what you see often in these types of cases where they're going after an officer, either civilly or criminally, because those are two very different spheres. Mm-hmm. What you see often is an officer will say, well, I relied on my training.
Right.
Okay. And what we will often see is they will say, well, that was really bad training, but the officer relied on it. And so many times you're actually giving somebody a break in that regard. You probably remember, Matt, years ago when we cycled out of chokeholds.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, for years, we were training officers. Here's how you chokehold, do the mm-hmm. carotid. And now we're finding out, oh, there's this ganglion nerve that's at yep. the base of the neck. And we can kill people that way, even though you shouldn't be able to cut off the flow to their brain and kill them in such a short period of time. People were dying.
Right.
So, rather than charging officers, people were saying, well, that's some really bad training and we need to clean up the training. However, now you've got a different situation that you're talking about, Justin, where an mm-hmm. officer has gotten some good training or should have received the good training, the appropriate training, and now is violating procedures, violating policies, those sorts of things, whatever the case may be. And I'm going to tell you, it happens all the time. And hearkening back to what Matt said, there's good officers and bad officers. And I don't mean that there's officers who do their job well or do their job poorly. I mean, there's officers that walk in that shouldn't be wearing a badge, and there's right. officers who do a great job. I think what people don't realize is how hard the job of being an officer is and how poorly we prepare people mm-hmm. for that job. I mean, how many classes did you get in counseling and domestic violence and family relations and all that stuff right out of the academy, Matt?
Yeah, right? None.
Right.
Yeah, no. When you talk law enforcement training, I think everybody thinks, oh, I've been trained. I revert back to my training. Well, can you tell me exactly what the training was? Because I'm guessing it was 3 years ago during that continuing officer training that you're talking about that we maybe talked about this in an 8-hour block.
Right.
And so I think training is, when I was in the academy, we went through 16 weeks in the academy. We had everything from criminal law to firearms to arrest tactics to field problems to driving, pursuit driving, all these different things. And my first trainer told me, first day on the job, get my stuff, throw it in the patrol car. And he says, forget everything you just learned, because it's not reality. Remember the handcuffing techniques? And remember what the laws are, and everything else is out the door. And that is what happens to these police officers when they get out there, is when they're saying they're reverting back to their training, 9 out of 10 times they're talking about the academy. And for some officers, that was 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But when you talk firearms training, it's quarterly. You have to be certified at a specific score. You have to qualify with the firearm that you carry. Everybody on that department carries the same ammunition. There's no more grain in my bullet than in your bullet. It's all the same. And yeah, there's people who reload their own and try to carry their own bullets and different things like that. And it you shouldn't be in it. It doesn't work that way. But you cannot, training does not happen in a split second. Mm-hmm. Reverting right. back to your training. That's why it says I was fear for my life or the life of another person.
Yeah. And, what you just mentioned is just so interesting to me, Matt, because I've heard this over and over again. I've seen it over and over again. You go to the academy, you get 16 weeks. That sounds like a lot, right? 16 weeks. Mm-hmm. And you're covering everything from, firing a weapon to driving to defensive tactics to the law. Okay? But you had 16 weeks that maybe, I would estimate, maybe 20 hours at best covered the in-depth law, right?
Oh, that's on the, yeah, 20. Maybe. I wouldn't even go 20.
Yeah,
oh,
maybe. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
And now you're playing in our arena,
yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. Where the bar to entry is 3 years of law school. Okay.
Yeah.
So there shouldn't be a surprise, or people shouldn't be surprised when they see this happening, where we have law enforcement officers that have, you know, very minimal training on the legal side of things, and that's mixed in with all this other stuff, and now we're sending them out there into these hot zones. And guess what happens when you're the rookie guy right out of the academy? Are you getting the nice Sunday shift?
Mm-hmm. Now you're getting every bad call known to man.
Exactly. You're getting out there. You're out on the graveyard shift. You know, you're out there where it's active. So we're taking the people who are newest with the least life experience, and we're throwing them into the most, you know, scary, dangerous, tricky legal situations that we can think of. So there shouldn't be a surprise to people why things do occasionally go wrong. The surprise should be that it doesn't go wrong a lot more,
right.
quite frankly.
Right.
But this is why I always come back to the issue with officers and training. I'm a defense attorney. I have always been a defense attorney. I've never been a prosecutor. But I live in this community,
mm-hmm.
right? And my kids live in this community. And I want a safe community. And I want law enforcement officers that know what they're doing and that are good citizens, just like I want to be a good citizen. And so I fully support law enforcement and police officers. I fully support the training. I wish we had the opportunity to do more. But the reality is, when it comes down to it, even with well-trained officers, they get into these moments. And this is why courts have acknowledged and say, look, I can't look at this, you know, with hindsight. I can't look at this, you know, on Monday morning. I have to look at this like this was Saturday morning at 2 a.m. You know, the bars just let out and now things are going crazy. So, you know, I understand that there's a lot at play. I understand it's very, very difficult when you're in that mix. I've seen, you know, lots of situations where they'll take civilians and run them through the officer shoot, don't shoot stuff, you know, in the simulators.
Right.
And everybody's dead.
Yeah, right? Everybody.
Yeah. So I appreciate how tough it is. And I think that's also important, you know, that the court has recognized that, and particularly in the Graham case. One of the things that they said that kind of gets pushed to the end, because everybody's focused on the three-prong test and objectionably reasonable. One of the things they specifically said, and I don't want to quote from it, and this is one of the head notes in the Graham case, it says, the question is whether officers' actions are, quote, objectively reasonable, quote, in light of facts, not the narrative, but in light of facts and circumstances confronting them, without regard to their underlying intent or motivation. And that blows past people a lot of time until they see it in action, and then they get a little bit worked up about it. I'm going to give you the classic one. We've just seen here recently a shooting up in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. where after the shooting, what did you hear the agent saying, right? The shooting has happened, and he's swearing. I'm not going to use mm-hmm. the swear words. I guess we can cut it out or whatever. I'll use it. He's like, fucking bitch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the narrative. Okay,
right.
So the narrative is that this guy wanted to execute this woman. That was the narrative that went out based on that statement. And I understand that narrative. I'm sure as a law enforcement officer, you've never heard anybody use bad words.
Never.
Right. So, but the point of it is what the Supreme Court was saying is, we're looking at the facts that led up to that shooting. If the officer just happened to hate, you know, protesters and wanted to kill people or got very angry or whatever the situation might be, the only way that has an impact is on the reasonableness assessment that we're doing up front, on
right.
those prongs that we're doing up front. So even if this officer, you know, was acting improperly in certain ways or violating policies in certain ways, we're still looking at the Graham factors.
Right, but the issue is in all this, for me, it's not what he said. It's not why he said it. It's not that he shot into the car. What matters is what he was thinking at the time. At the time of the specific event
right.
when he was shooting his firearm into the car, it's not whether he did 3 rounds or 13 rounds
right.
and dumped his mag and put another round and did 13 more. None of that matters.
Yep.
What matters is what was going on in his head that he was stopping an imminent threat to his life.
Right. Mm-hmm. And to put it in a different way, Matt, exactly what we're saying here was it matters what was going on in his head, and was that objectively reasonable so that if you had another 5 or another 10 officers in that setting, they would say, I've got to do the same thing.
Right.
Not whether they would make the choice or not, because there's different officers that would say, well, I'm not going to fire a gun in that situation, or I'm not going to do this or that. But at that moment, in that split set of seconds, which was very fast,
yeah,
you know, is that objectively reasonable, or is that objectively not reasonable based on the factors that we've got here?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And not to go into war stories and all this other stuff, but I got drugged by a car probably 20 yards one day on a little gangster in Mesa. And as I'm being drugged by the car, I'm looking at my partner going, are you going to shoot this guy? I'm kind of getting drugged here. He's driving. You want to stop the threat, shoot the guy. In his mind was, holy cow, Matt's getting drugged by the car. Get Matt, try to pull Matt out of the car, almost save Matt's life, and we'll get this guy later. Another officer would say, oh, I'm going to shoot him to stop the threat. Mm-hmm. So to say officers are going to do the same thing in each incident, we can't. What would a reasonable officer do in a situation where a car is coming at them? One officer is going to jump out of the way.
Right.
One officer is going to fire his gun. And both of them are right. And the problem we have, at least the problem
legally
I have.
Legally speaking, which is what we care about here.
Both of them are right in that situation. Two rights, yeah, and the different result. But what happens is all of a sudden the media gets hold of it. Mm-hmm. And now we're having these different media networks and outlets taking a 5-second shot and dissecting it down to 2-3 hours of commentary.
Now we're back to the narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now we're away from the facts.
And we can't do that because now everybody is going off not the facts.
Right.
The guy was in fear for his life. He shot some rounds into the car. Stop the threat. We are not trained to shoot in the leg. We're not trained to shoot in the arm. We are trained to stop the threat.
Let's also be really clear on that too, for something that I think has made police work a much bigger mess these days, which is it's not just you've got countervailing narratives, but you've got tremendous financial incentives for those countervailing narratives, right? You are selling clicks, and the more outrageous it is, the better.
Yeah. Right.
And it doesn't matter which side of the spectrum you're on. There's, you know, a good half of the country that you're going to sell clicks to on one side and a good half on the other side.
Yeah.
And when journalists, and I use that word, unfortunately, you know, with air quotes, when journalists are getting in and they're worried about selling clicks because selling facts doesn't pay nearly as well,
right?
That's a huge problem.
Because if they sold the facts, that story would have been over a long time ago. Unfortunately, 100%. So.
I think that's a little optimistic, yeah. But I don't think it would have the heat that it has right now if people would just sell facts.
And if it was a local police officer that did that, it would have never hit the media.
Don't dispute that. Probably did happen that same day or the same
four
week.
Four or five times over.
Mm-hmm. Yep, but that's probably in Minneapolis.
Probably a topic for a different show.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, Joey, you bring up a great point. We had Dennis Root on the show, several times. He was the use of force expert on the Zimmerman case. And I'll tell you, we still get in the comments of those clips and those videos, people are going back and forth to this day. It's one of our most commented on, disputed reels that we've ever put out because there's so much emotion on either side.
Yeah.
And just to put a fine point on this, like if someone disagrees with the outcome of the use of force case, which is very common because what they see in the media isn't what was presented in the courtroom. It wasn't the totality of the circumstance. Does that necessarily mean that the law was misapplied? Can the law be applied correctly and still produce a result that people are pissed off about? Have you seen that in your practice,
Joey? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So there are really two components to our criminal justice system. And I'm a huge proponent of our criminal justice system. But I tell people it's a lot like that saying, I can't remember if it was Winston Churchill or somebody else had about democracy, right? Or a democratic form of government. I feel the same way about our justice system, which is it's the worst one there is, except for all the rest of them. Right? So look, it is imperfect. Anytime you get human beings involved, it is imperfect. There are going to be mistakes. And that's from jump. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's from on the street. That's when it gets to the court. That's when the defense attorney starts looking at it. The prosecutor starts looking at it. And so there's always going to be mistakes. We have two major components of any justice system, and that's procedural justice and then, you know, the result, the outcome.
Right.
Actual justice, substantive justice. Did you get the right decision and did you get it the right way? All right.
Mm-hmm.
Look, we could say we're going to get justice in a different way. We're going to go back and we're going to put people to the stake and burn them until they confess. Well, we would probably get accurate confessions sometimes when we did that. But I don't think anybody's in favor of doing that,
right,
because it's a really bad process and it's also going to give you bad results many mm-hmm. times. So there are different ways to get to an end result. But if you get to the right result the wrong way, yes, you are going to have exactly what you're talking about, which is anger, unhappiness, resentment, and then, quite frankly, disbelief.
Right.
Right. If it is an unfair process, nobody's going to believe that you got a fair result.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be a fair process. And in the United States, again, I know that we have lots of problems. I work constantly as a defense attorney, not just in the courtroom defending my clients, but in my community through organizations like our Attorneys on Retainer, through bar committees, through different groups, you know, with attorneys and lawyers and judges and police officers to try to make things better. But the reality is we're going to make mistakes. And the way that you get a process that people will support and believe in is it's got to be open. It's right. got to be transparent. Can't be hidden back in a dark room somewhere where people can't see what's going on. It's got to make sense. It's got to be rational. And then it's got to produce the right outcomes. If I had a great system that seemed rational and fair and open and it consistently produced wrong outcomes, we're doing something wrong.
You know, I'm all for transparency. I had a chief that was, he was all about being transparent. Transparent this, everything is transparent. And here's the problem in doing that. So you have, you're transparent and one of your officers does something. What's the first thing they do? They put them on suspension, whether it's admin suspension or unpaid suspension. That doesn't, all that matters is people hear suspension.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take that police officer and you put him on the stand. He's already labeled as being on suspension, so he's not, we right. can't trust him or anything. Transparency is key and crucial, I believe, in law enforcement, but there are pros and cons to it. And
right.
I think that we, I'm just going to be I love cops. I was a cop. I think police work is one of the most thankless jobs there is.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I did it. But at the same time, we get screwed over all the time just because of transparency, yeah. body cameras. Body cameras have probably saved more officers than hurt. But once we label or once we put somebody in that boat of a bad, suspended, in trouble, Brady list, all these different things. Now, Brady list, throw that out. Those guys shouldn't be police officers if they're lying in court. We're just causing problems for the police officer.
I don't disagree with you on a tag like suspension. I've often thought, look, there should be a different name, right? There should be a different category. If for nothing else, I mean, for people who have been involved in shootings, God forbid somebody injured and God really forbid that somebody's dead, right? There needs to be, you know, some separation at that moment. It's like, just back up for a second and take a break. If nothing else, at least for the appearance of propriety, if mm-hmm. you will. Like, hey, somebody just got involved in a shooting and shot and killed somebody. There's questions. I'll just put them back out there. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is, look, it is unusual, in my opinion, to have somebody that's involved in taking the life of another human being and there's not some side effects to that, right? There's issues that go on. People play these things over in their head all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Could I have done this differently? Could I have done that differently? Now, there are people who don't have those feelings or thoughts or concerns. Sometimes we call those people sociopaths. But real people who take action that has real serious consequences, they're going to feel that.
Right.
But I don't disagree with you that labeling a normal, regular, what should happen timeout, a suspension, which is the same thing we call it when somebody's being investigated, That's bad. That creates a bad optic for law enforcement. I agree with that entirely.
That whole officer-involved shooting, having lived through it.
Well, let's define that, okay? And you've lived through it, mm-hmm. but I'm sure you've lived through it in multiple variants, right? We say officer-involved shooting, and what I've seen half the time is there's five guys there. Everybody's tagged. One guy shot, maybe two guys shot, okay? The other guys didn't do anything,
but
and I don't
there.
Mean that good or I don't mean that right. good or bad. I mean they didn't discharge a weapon, and they're all involved, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're going to go that way, then if you're going to call those officer involved shootings, and I mean, there's all kinds of them,
right?
But the actual pulling the trigger, shootings, you know, yeah, I've been involved, and the whole process, and this would be a great show because we're getting off topic here, but. The whole process from the time you fire your weapon till the time you show up back at home that night or that next day is horrible.
Yeah.
It's a horrible experience. And then 9 months later, it takes 9 months to get the letter from the county attorney mm-hmm. saying you're cleared.
Yeah.
And that's 9 months of hell.
Yeah.
And so I don't think there's many officers out there that go to work and say, yeah, I've had such a bad day today. I just want to beat the hell out of somebody.
Right.
Are there those? Probably. I don't know. I never worked with them. But I think that when it comes to the court system and people and the media and the labels that are put on police officers, I think we all need to just stop and take a step back and really, as you said, check the facts. And once, if your facts lead you to a dirty cop, then crucify him.
Right.
But if your facts lead you to a person that acted within the laws, who felt in fear for his life, then you need to back off because mm-hmm. he doesn't need to hear. Luckily, on one of my shootings, they didn't put my name in the paper, and I was so grateful for that.
Yeah,
you were lucky.
You know,
yep.
Yeah, I was lucky. And so there's just a lot of psychological stuff that comes in with law enforcement and all this other stuff and. I'm glad we have attorneys that want to protect and that want to take care of the police officers who actually need the help. And I think it's the best that everybody involved, mm-hmm. and I think that's why you're doing this episode, is that everybody involved understands, hey, please step back, turn the stupid news off, and let the facts play out. And yeah. then after the facts play out, turn the news on and see what the outcome is.
It's true. It's true. Yeah. The public perception, in my view, has destroyed the ability for people to think critically and to sort through what actually happened and apply the law to yeah. it and apply common sense to it. You know, I want to talk about the line that the court drew when it came to deadly force. And for the listeners out there, I'll say this one is a little bit harder to hear. This is the Tennessee versus Garner case. So it's 1974, Memphis, it's nighttime. Police get a burglary call. Officer Elton Hyman responds and arrives at the scene. He sees a figure in the backyard, someone fleeing. The person is headed for a chain link fence. Hyman can see him clearly enough to tell his hands are empty and no weapon. Now under Tennessee law at the time, that didn't matter. The law said if a suspect is fleeing, you can use deadly force to stop him, period. Hyman shot Edward Garner in the back of the head as he climbed the fence. Edward Garner was 15 years old. He died at the hospital. So what did he steal? $10 and a purse. His father sued, and the case went to the Supreme Court. The court ruled that deadly force against a fleeing suspect is unconstitutional unless the suspect poses a significant threat of death or serious physical injury to the officer or to others. You can't shoot someone in the back just because they're running. And that decision drew a hard constitutional line on when police can use lethal force. So the Supreme Court rejected the old common law rule that allowed deadly force simply to prevent escape. The standard now required that probable cause, to believe the suspect poses a significant threat or deadly or serious physical injury. So Matt, I want to start with you on this one. I want to ask you something personal. When you first heard the facts of this case, 15-year-old kid, unarmed, shot climbing a fence, what went through your mind as someone who carried a badge?
Oh, I'm putting myself in that situation, I don't know what, maybe it's just a kid running from his girlfriend. I have no idea what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, and not to second guess or Monday morning quarterback or anything else, would I have shot? Probably not. Because that's why we as police officers were investigators.
Right.
We have to investigate. We don't, just because somebody's running from a shoplifting doesn't mean we can shoot them. Just because somebody's running from, if they are involved in a shooting, they have the gun with them, they pose a threat to the community, and then the fleeing felon rule, in my opinion, would apply.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? If we take our investigative tools and tactics out of law enforcement, then this is what's going to happen.
Right.
And I, luckily for me in my career, you know, I would run after him and grab him off the fence. You know, a 15-year-old kid, grab him, put him off the fence, put some handcuffs on him, and deal with
and
it then.
See what happened.
Yeah.
Right.
That's called investigation.
So, Joey, in that scenario, can we talk about what a significant threat actually means? Does the person have to have a weapon? What if they just committed a crime and they're running from it? They committed a violent crime. Does that alone meet the standard in your eyes?
Can I add one real quick thing?
Feel free.
But if I grab him and all of a sudden the gun falls out of the front of his pants,
mm-hmm.
or he grabs for a gun, that changes the whole scenario.
Right, you've got an active situation.
Now you have a scenario that person has to be stopped, because we don't know if the gun was used in the house. We don't know if he stole the gun.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we have to investigate what's going on.
Right.
So a couple things on that. First of all, again, remember, these are all in the context of civil rights cases,
mm-hmm.
right? And so we are talking about constitutional issues, but in the light of civil rights cases, right. Not in the light of, was the officer in that case charged with a crime? Because this has nothing to do with charging him with a crime, because
right.
as far as I know, he was never charged with a crime of any sort,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's the first issue. Second issue is, in some ways, as much as we try, we're still not following the Graham requirements, right? Because the way that we pose the question is, 15-year-old kid running away, jumping and climbing a fence. Well, how do I know that?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I see a dark figure on a dark night running away from me, or whatever the scenario mm-hmm. is, right? And so when we start adding in these facts that are not known at the time, that's what really, you know, starts to create some of the cognitive dissonance that we hear, like, right. well, you shot a 15-year-old kid, yeah. you know, you shot an emergency RN nurse who was just there trying to help somebody else, right? That's, again, that's narrative. That's not facts.
Mm-hmm.
And facts that are known at the time, facts that are known to the person involved in this case. And again, what the Graham court said, is we need to limit ourselves in making these decisions to the facts known to the officer and the actions taken, and then say, was that objectively reasonable? Now, in the Garner case, sure, we can sit here after the fact and say that's not reasonable, just based on some of those facts. But now let's look at, you know, the reality of what we had in that circumstance. And let's also talk about the training that we talked about earlier,
mm-hmm.
right? Because everybody said, yeah, you can shoot and kill a suspect under those circumstances. And the Supreme Court in Garner is saying, nope. Matter of fact, it wasn't just they said it was okay. Tennessee had a statute, essentially, that allowed
right.
that to happen.
Exactly.
So it wasn't just that I had training. I had
the law
on my
side.
Right? Interestingly, if this had been a criminal case against the officer, I think that would have been a major issue preventing him from being charged in any way, shape, or form, right. or throwing the case out, or getting a not guilty verdict, or whatever the case may be, which are, you know, that's my arena. Those are the places I live. What the Supreme Court here was doing was saying, no, we're going to shift kind of the goalposts, if you will, or not shift the goalposts, but shift some boundaries that we've had for a long time in certain areas. And they sent a real message to law enforcement. And this was in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
And again, remember who they're sending the message to. It's not really law enforcement, because what this is about is a civil lawsuit paying money. And all your years as an officer, I'm sure you were sued multiple times. Did you ever have to pay money out of your pocket as an award?
No.
Right. So the likelihood of that happening is very, very low,
mm-hmm.
right?
But I need to also add
mm-hmm.
that they never ruled to take the money. I always won.
Exactly. There's that. But I'm going to tell you, even
just kind of clear that up.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. But even if it was the other way around, right. let me ask you something. All the officers, you know, they're all millionaires, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Everyone.
Of course they're not,
yeah.
right? I'm going to tell you, day one of law school, you know what they teach you? Never, ever, never, never, ever, never, ever, never sue poor people. Right? So 1983 actions are against the government. You're right. Naming the officers, and if they had money, you'd be happy to collect that too.
Right.
But the real message that the Supreme Court was sending here was to state and local governments to say, hey, you guys are going to be writing checks if you don't change the training that we talked about, and say, look, you can't shoot 15-year-old kids in the back. It looks bad, right? And it violates the Constitution, by the way. So that's one of the things that's really going on here is the Supreme Court isn't pulling the rug out from officers at this point. The Supreme Court is sending a message to state and local governments and entities saying, stop doing this. Stop training your officers like this. Just like when we get lawsuits for a death from a chokehold. You guys are still doing chokeholds? Really? You know, after all the stuff that's happened, okay, maybe somebody needs to write a check. Because maybe. The one thing we know is that governments aren't people, they're entities, and they have institutional memory, and that institutional memory is based on money flowing out.
Right. And so, that's why the pursuits, we don't pursue anymore.
Exactly. It's because of the lawsuits.
You're tired of paying out.
Right. Exactly. Because of the lawsuits. So back to this issue, though, and the issue of the reasonableness at that point in time. Again, one of the things you're going to see in these cases, if anybody cares to read these cases. So, for instance, the Garner case, it's 105 Supreme Court 1694 or there's some other sites, but that's the primary. 105 Supreme Court 1694 is where Garner starts.
We can link to those in the show notes.
Yep. And one of the things that you're going to see is they always go back to basics and start talking about, well, what was the constitutional right? And it sounds silly, but they start out by saying, oh, shooting somebody is a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. Okay, so I've shot you and brought you down. I've seized you under the Fourth Amendment. Sure. So that's the constitutional right that we're protecting. Okay, it's not a due process issue. We didn't have a trial, and we're not holding officers to the point where they've got to give somebody due process in a courtroom at that point. It's, did you seize them? Okay, if I seize them now, was that seizure unreasonable? If I have, and we've all seen these videos, you know, somebody who's having a really bad day, and, you know, some officer, some 6'2" state trooper pulls a, you know, 65-year-old grandmother out of the car and slams her face down, and everybody's like, wow, what in the world is going on here? Well, you look at it, and everybody's like, well, that's not reasonable, right? That behavior is not reasonable. It's not proportionate. It's not timely, meaning there's no immediate imminent threat. And again, these are some of the same steps that civilians go through when they're in self-defense cases. Is your action reasonable as a civilian? There's a difference here. Okay. So if I'm a civilian in this circumstance, I can't think of a world where I can shoot this kid and not get charged with a homicide or an aggravated assault or whatever the case may be, right? There's an exception for law enforcement, where law enforcement gets a little more leeway than a normal civilian does in the, when they're operating in their law enforcement arena. That wasn't really clear, though, Justin, until quite a few years later in 2007 when the Harris case came out. Because, frankly, the Garner case, to me, when you read it, it actually sounds an awful lot like putting law enforcement on the same playing field, if you will, as civilians using deadly force. Because when I'm a civilian using deadly force, you know, is there an imminent threat? Is it a threat to my life or somebody else's life or to their safety? You know, it could kill them or harm them seriously. And is there basically, you know, no other step that I can take to stop this threat? Now, you can get into all sorts of situations about, do I have a duty to retreat? And that's state by state. Mm-hmm. Okay. But the reality is it proportional? Is it imminent? You know, that's the way you've got to look at it. And that sounded like what Garner was doing. And it wasn't until some later on cases, including Scott, where they kind of reeled that back in a little bit and said, well, look, if I'm driving down the road and I see a car fleeing and weaving in and out of traffic, and I hear over the radio, hey, there's this car, and there's a white Bronco. It's fleeing down the freeway, right? I strike that. A different vehicle. Driving down the freeway, weaving in and out of traffic, can I, as a citizen, do a pit maneuver on him and kick him into the side? Of course not. No. Everybody knows that, right? Mm-hmm. What about if you're the law enforcement officer? Well, that's that's what Garner kind of left up in the air. We weren't sure what was going on with Garner until we got cases like Scott versus Harris that really started defining it. What does that mean? And it gave more leeway to officers. Again, remember, not in the case of what can I do and not be charged, but what can I do and not be sued, mm-hmm. or at least to have my qualified immunity still in place.
Right. Well, you know, you bring up an interesting point, Joey, because courts often, and especially in the media, we often talk about the distinction between fear, you know, the officer who feared for their life or identified some sort of, had some sort of lawful threat assessment. Can you explain that? Because a lot of people hear the officer feared for their life and they think that that's the whole analysis, that I was scared and that's the legal standard. At least that's how it's being portrayed currently. Could you talk to that?
Sure. So people are afraid of things all the time.
Right.
Right. And you know this, Matt, I'm sure there's days where you are out there and you're like, boy, this doesn't feel right. Right. Something about this just feels wrong. And it probably was wrong.
See, but that's common sense, not
right.
fear.
That's common sense.
Right.
Well, I get that, but that fear was there, but I would bet.
Never did. I wasn't scared of it.
Right, exactly. But I would bet that there were times where that alarm bell is going off
yes.
and you didn't shoot anybody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Probably didn't even pull your weapon out.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the difference between fear and between a threat, between reasonably assessing a threat.
Right.
And reasonableness, this is a poor way of looking at it, but it is a way that I think can be helpful to certain people. If I was in that situation, would I do the same thing? Knowing what I know now,
mm-hmm.
would I do the same thing? And I don't mean now I know all the facts that I didn't know, right? But in the cold light of day, looking back at the facts that I had, would I say, okay, I did the right thing? Or would I say, no, I should have done something differently. And I acknowledge and understand that is not a way to look at this and do a legal analysis. But I think it is a way to look at it as somebody on the street and say, okay, did I learn anything from this? And if I learned, would I now handle that case differently? If that's the situation, that doesn't mean that it was a bad shoot or a bad use of force. It means that I made a mistake.
Right.
And now I'm changing and I'm learning for that. And hopefully it wasn't a mistake that arose to a constitutional violation. It was a mistake that was just a human error that the court's going to look at and say, well, humans can make those errors under those circumstances.
Right. And here's my people need to understand that there's the civil side of things. There's a criminal side of mm-hmm. things. All right. The criminal side of things is probable cause to believe that the crime is afoot. Probable cause to believe that this person committed the crime, therefore we take him to jail, and then we take him to court. After it's all adjudicated, then the civil portion comes into it. And it seems like in the civil law, it's not probable cause. It's can I make the judge or jury cry? And once I reach that emotional factor with the judge or jury, then regardless of whether or not the police officer was right or wrong, it doesn't really matter. Because now that emotional pull at the heartstrings is going to say, yeah, he shouldn't have done that. He shouldn't have pulled that 60-year-old woman out of the car and put her on the trunk of the car, even though she was going for a gun that was underneath her back, or even though that she had a knife in her hand that she was trying to stab somebody, the passenger or herself with. See, because they pull the heartstrings and say, oh, you can't do that to a 60-year-old right. woman. And that's why it's so important, whether we're talking criminal or civil, is that we got to let these facts play out. Because there's a lot of police officers that say, and I hate it when they say this, I went my whole career without pulling my gun. Anybody can do it. They're a liar. Felony stops, you pull your guns. Building searches, you pull your guns. And the only difference, the only thing that separates them from actually using the gun is sliding your finger off the side of the gun onto the trigger and pulling the trigger, which is like that. In that amount of time, a decision is made. And if you're going to pull at the heartstrings of the jury is always going to win. They're going to win. But if you look at the law and a police officer did everything he could do, and what separates a good shoot from a bad shoot, besides the law, of course, is policy of the police department. If I violate the policy of the police department, I will be hung out to dry, and the city will not cover me in a civil lawsuit. I will lose my job. Therefore, I have no no city paying my attorneys, no anything, and I'll be hung out to dry. And we need to remember that it seems like we spend more time crying about the person that was justifiably hurt, injured, killed, instead of saying, holy cow, I'm glad we have police officers that actually do their job and protect our communities. And I think in law, man, gray. Everything is gray. There's no black. There's no white. I don't know how many juries I've sat in front of, how many times I've testified in court. And there's always, when you get done, you're thinking, oh, crap, did I say the right thing? Oh, shoot, that defense attorney, he got me. Joey's had me say this. Did I say the right thing? You're looking at the prosecutor, and the prosecutor's doing this stuff. You know, and it's like, but that's what happened.
Yeah.
And it's just crazy. It's probably one of the greatest movies on earth, an actual live movie. It's not watching Lincoln Lawyer on Netflix. It's actually sitting down and watching an actual high-profile court case happen in front of your eyes and feeling the emotions in the courtroom that's causing the jury to go the way they go.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I agree with you, Matt, that there's always a concern that emotion or passion will overcome facts and reality and rationale. I get that. However, look at your case. Right? How many times have you been in there and you've been sued and never once had that happen to you? Right?
Because I'm good.
Or you had a good lawyer.
Yeah. Right? Both. I'll go with both.
Right. Kind of a reverse Shawshank.
Yeah. Right? Exactly. Right? No, so, you're right. You're right.
So, but the point of it is I get it when you're in that chair, it feels like everybody's attacking you and nobody has your back. Yep. I do understand that. That's just a part of the system. On the other hand, again, I think, you know, we see jurisdictions where it is swinging really wildly one way, swinging really wildly another way. We need to have a situation where you can walk down the streets without fear.
Right.
And that's without fear of being attacked by a criminal. And that's without fear of, you know, being rousted by a police officer. Mm-hmm. Right. I don't want to live in Mexico. Yeah. Right. Right. And I grew up on the border and I love going to Mexico. Mm-hmm. And I love the people in Mexico and I don't want to live there. I don't want to live where I'm worried about, you know, constantly, are the bad guys going to get me or are the good guys going to get me?
Right.
Right. And so, yes, in our civil society, I think people don't understand. We call it a civil society. And many times, particularly those of us in the criminal justice arena, we give short shrift to our peers, our colleagues on the civil side of it. But the reality is it's the civil side that oftentimes keeps the lid on a society, keeps it from blowing up. Because right. If you believe that there's nowhere I can go to right a wrong, I'm not talking about the criminal court because an individual isn't suing anybody in criminal court. But if you believe, hey, a police officer shot my son in the back while he's running away and there's nothing I can do about it.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you.
What's your last option?
I'm with you.
We don't want that as an option. Right. So the civil system really is there to resolve these disputes and to help us to have that civil society. And it comes with costs.
Right.
It just does.
For sure. And I know that like you said earlier, Justin, that I think the first time we met was on an Aryan Brotherhood case. And we actually got that guy off death row.
Yeah. You didn't like that guy.
Holy cow. Matt Browning, the guy who fights Aryan Brotherhood, got a guy that wanted to be Aryan Brotherhood off death row. I thought in my life I'd never do that.
Right.
But you know what? Justice is justice.
Right.
And fair is fair.
Yes.
And we need to make sure that not just this person get off death row, but everybody has the same thing. Is the judicial system fair and just and right? I don't know. I locked a guy up for 7 years on a murder and another Hispanic gangster for 21 years for dealing with a pound of weed. Where's the justice and where's the fairness?
Yep.
But that's not on me. I made the arrest and we went forward from there.
Right. Yeah.
And so rule of law is rule of law.
Yeah. Yeah. That's and okay. we try to emphasize that with folks all the time as defense attorneys, because we get hammered all the time. I had a very high profile death penalty case going on one time, and this very nice little old lady came up to my wife at church and says, "How can Joey represent that guy? Like, it's a horrible crime. How can he represent that guy?" Mm-hmm. look, the reality is I'm not representing an act.
Mm-hmm.
And many times I'm not actually even representing a human being. I'm representing the Constitution.
Yep.
I'm representing liberty and freedom. And I don't have a dog in the fight, so to speak, about a specific act, but I certainly do about the Constitution.
Oh, for sure.
And if we're going to, you know, put somebody in prison, we're going to take away somebody's life, we better make sure it's done correctly.
Right.
And what I can tell you is that in our system, which is an adversarial system, we tell that to people from high school on and nobody understands what it means. An adversarial system, though, means that if the defense attorney isn't doing everything that she or he can, that means you're going to get the wrong result.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The wrong result. And so, you know, I appreciate, as officers, you guys often feel like you're in the crosshairs, and you are.
Yeah.
You are figuratively and literally in the crosshairs. Mm-hmm. But the reality is we don't expect officers to be superhuman or perfect. Just about a week ago, we were having our annual convention for the attorneys on retainer, and our founder got up and said, we represent people all the time. He says, and I've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of use of force incidents. And I can tell you there's not a single one that's picture perfect, where right. somebody later on couldn't come in and say, well, you did this or you did that, or I think you were completely wrong. So there's no picture perfect use of force. I don't care if it's captured on video and you got, you know, the Pope and the president swearing for you. It's not going to be perfect. There's going to be mistakes and issues along the way. That's not the standard.
Mm-hmm.
Standard isn't perfection. It is objectively reasonable. This is the difference now, kind of coming back full circle to what you were talking about, between fear and reasonable use of force, right? An imminent threat.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is it objective? You can have somebody who is a paranoid schizophrenic. Remember the famous case up in Flagstaff where the guy, you know, believed that the aliens were there to kidnap him mm-hmm. and believed that it was the officer pulling him over that was an alien there to kidnap him and probe him or whatever else right. it was going to be and killed him, right? Well, that's not objectively reasonable,
mm-hmm.
right? And you know, you can argue that. That's the Clark case. You can argue that 50 different ways. It always surprised me that we wouldn't say that person is so unhinged from reality that, you know, we can't hold them to the same standard that we're holding other people
exactly.
to. But that's what our Supreme Court yep. said.
Right. 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 However, the police officer who, if a police officer did shoot a person like that, the cop would be hung out to dry.
Oh, of course.
Probably.
Of course.
Yeah.
No, they'd be rightfully prosecuted and sued, and the department would be sued and all mm-hmm. those sorts of things. But just so you understand too, Matt, this isn't just the way it is for police officers.
No, it's for
right?
people.
If you are an employee of any entity or agency mm-hmm. and you do something, they're getting sued, right?
right.
And all their training is getting called into question right. and all sorts of things like that. So.
Security guards at the football games.
Right.
They're all in the same thing. Bank
exactly.
guards, everybody. They're all in the same boat.
Right.
And I understand that.
Right.
And just from working in that arena for so many years and going through the different processes and the different, you know, it just makes you sit back and think, how in the freaking world did I get out of that?
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
how in the world, not out of being a bad cop because I was a good cop, not out of the, but how did I get out with my, with intact?
Right, with my sanity, mm-hmm. my soul, everything else intact.
That's up for discussion.
Yeah. That's it.
We'll ask your wife about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you can read
we'll
the book.
Have her back
read the book
right,
on that
okay.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here today. We're going to continue this discussion with some other current events here in the near future, but I want to thank you both. Joey, any last takeaways you want our audience to remember as they leave?
Yeah, one of the things I want them to remember again is we're not asking people to be perfect.
Right.
We're asking people to be reasonable, which seems to be getting harder and harder to ask these days. If you were to go to our website, the Attorneys on Retainer YouTube channel, you will see we've got a video there of a security guard
mm-hmm.
who was protecting little children at a Jewish day school when a man came in and there was just a horrible scene. It's all on his body camera
mm-hmm.
and he ended up having to shoot and kill the man. And yes, we were able to prevent him from being prosecuted criminally. So mm-hmm. he's not being charged with a homicide, but of course he's being sued.
Right.
right. And so we're standing behind him both on the criminal and the civil side of it. But that's what happens in these cases. So You just have to be ready for that. I don't care if you're a police officer mm-hmm. or a civilian. Doesn't matter what you are.
Sure.
You said one thing at the beginning, and I always try to emphasize this to people because I talk a lot to people in the Second Amendment community and the self-defense community. And we all agree that we want to have freedoms and liberties and everything. But I tell people the best way to survive a gunfight is don't get in a gunfight.
Yeah.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah.
I feel like getting in a gunfight for most of us as citizens is a failure. It's a failure of circumstances. It's a failure of, you know, recognition of your surroundings, all those sorts of things. That's not always the case. You're home and you get a home invasion.
Totally different.
Yeah, different story. But so many of these things that we see all the time, even justifiable shootings, could have been avoided with a little bit of common sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Matt, anything you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, you know, I like to thank you, Justin and Joey. I think you brought humanity to law enforcement. You let people know that we're people too. And you know, there's things that do need to happen. There's changes that must happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that this discussion has showed that that I think we're all in the same boat here, and that police officers don't want to hurt anybody. And when you're thrown into a situation where this happens, this is the process that we go through. The laws, the everything is great to know. Title 13 is a great book if you want to read it and learn about what mm-hmm. a homicide is or a burglary or anything else. But I think that with all the events going on, and I mean, we've had so many officer-involved shootings here in the Valley in the last month. We've had what's going on in Tucson with the kidnapping. We have the things in Minnesota, all over the place. We can just Google right now and find out how many shootings there's been. And I think that what you did, and I appreciate what you said, Joey, is that, you know, we just need to step back and check the facts. Mm-hmm. Before you check shut your mouth before you check the facts.
Yeah.
We don't need people talking trash. We don't need people conspiracy theories throwing out all this other garbage. Check the facts, man.
Right.
So thanks. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you both for being here. This episode may have challenged how you evaluate viral videos or headline-driven reactions. The law is not perfect, but it is specific. You can disagree with the standard, or you can argue it should change, but analysis must start with what the law says. If this conversation gave you clarity or raised new questions, subscribe, turn on notifications, and join the discussion. Follow Truth Be Found on social media and let us know what you think about our discussion today and what you'd like to learn about next. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll be back soon to break down more of what you need to know about your rights and those of others. Empowering yourself by understanding the facts and knowing your rights is a great way to be patriotic.
Thank you for tuning in to Truth Be Found. The hunt for answers never stops, and neither do we. Don't forget to subscribe and follow us online to stay in the loop. Remember, truth has a way of coming to light. Until next time, keep your head up and your eyes sharp.